Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the material conditions for ordinary Soviet citizens between about 1928 and 1933, so really the duration of the first five-year plan. So we will delve back a little further than that. And we'll talk about two main things, food shortages and housing shortages, and really what those tell us about Stalinism. As I've mentioned previously, during the second five-year plan and as a part of the Stakhanovite movement, there was a move towards trying to create Soviet consumerism, or trying to create a kind of a Soviet version of a state-led version of American-style consumerism. And this was something that was quite close to Stalin's heart. So this was ultimately a desirable goal for Soviet society. But the first five-year plan that focused on heavy industry really achieves the opposite and creates immense shortages of foodstuffs, of basic household items, and of housing. And it's housing that I want to talk about first. During the Civil War period, there was a policy of consolidation. This is the policy, really, of moving large numbers of poor working-class families into middle-class houses and apartments in the cities of Russia, places like Moscow, and then Leningrad. There is a great deal of apartment living. This is the kind of the structure of inner city life for the bourgeoisie of the pre-revolutionary period, and the express ideological reasoning behind consolidation was to bring about an enforced equality, to give poor working class families accommodation in nicer middle class apartments, and really to Soviet secret police and the administrators of the policy from the local municipal authorities had sort of barely disguised glee at humiliating the middle classes. Though a great many of them were drawn from the middle classes themselves. And the policy of consolidation was part of Lenin's war on what he viewed as being the internal front. So a policy of degradation, gradually, of the lives and conditions of the middle classes in Russia, and a policy of kind of proletarianization of the middle classes, the combination of taking any surplus space from them, cramming large numbers of people into their apartments, many of whom were alien to them, their manners seemingly rough and crude, it seems an almost universal experience of the bourgeoisie just after the revolution who are consolidated, that their homes are wrecked, that there is cigarette smoke and drinking and wild parties, and things are broken, the carpets are wrecked, you know, toilets are left in an unspeakable state, and there is a tacit encouragement to do this by the various organs of the Bolsheviks, various writings in papers, revolutionary papers, encouraging the proletariat to behave as aggressively and in a confrontational way to the bourgeoisie, the expropriators, as possible. A combination of this and forcing many of the middle classes to participate in forced manual labour was part of Lenin's idea to proletarianise the middle classes. After 1928, with the commencement really of the Stalin era and the Cultural Revolution, which is really a prelude to the five-year plans, there's less of an overt ideological motivation for consolidation. Not that the Stalin and his contemporaries didn't share similar ideological goals, of course they did. It's simply that the bourgeoisie homes have, you know, were consolidated a decade earlier, and that process has really been concluded. The period from 1928 onwards sees a massive increase in overcrowding. Not because there really are any more bourgeoisie to torment and humiliate. The kind of ideological consolidation was at its height during the 1920s. No, the process of the overcrowding of the towns and cities really is firstly the result of the five-year plans, as industrialisation sucks agricultural workers and peasants from the grinding poverty of the countryside into the towns and cities where there appears to be jobs and work, which is a process which is encouraged by the party. The party, the Soviet government, does very little to provide new housing. This means that the housing stock that exists, some of it occupied by the former bourgeoisie, much of it occupied by the workers, sees an immense pressure put on it by huge influxes of people coming from the countryside and rooms having to be found in communal apartments. The Soviet idea of the communal apartment, some of which were now being built, but only really the new builds were only really happening in the new cities, places like Magnitogorsk, in many of the regular the established towns and cities that had existed for centuries. All that happens is that existing apartments get more and more subdivided. But anyway, the point about communal living was that the ideological point was that the Soviets believed it would lead to some kind of greater collectivism, that ultimately this is another one of the ways that Lenin believed that, you know, people would be educated in socialism. They would be taught to share. They'd be taught to abandon this kind of fetishism for objects and possessions, and taught to forget the need for ownership and focus on more communal values. And this is one of the very kind of almost spiritual notions of Soviet communism, that you would finally free people from this oppressive relationship to things. Of course, that doesn't happen at all. In fact, it makes the situation far, far worse, as you have people crammed into flats where each individual has a couple of square metres to call their own. There is fierce demarcation of territory, as you would imagine. The utensils within kitchens are jealously guarded, and so are foodstuffs, and there's a huge increase in mental illness as a result of these the policies of enforced consolidation communal living. People have no privacy. They have to deal with all sorts of social problems that are imposed upon them. There's an immense amount of stress all the time. Exacerbating factor in all of this is the role of the state, in that individuals that are envious of one another, people that are resentful that a certain family has a bigger room, can constantly threaten to denounce them to the state, can constantly threaten to inform on them to the secret police and refer to them as counter-revolutionaries and class enemies and these sort of things, and possibly kulaks and all sorts of frightening accusations in order to get the room off them, or in order to settle some kind of petty score. So this is not really the kind of socialist communal harmonious living that Lenin had in mind. In some apartments, there are new paper-thin walls are put in. In others, rooms are simply partitioned by a clothesline and some old sheets. The result of having people forced together cheek by jowl is that there is the surveillance state doesn't really need to do much work. Instead of having a surveillance state, you have a surveillance society. So society is spying on itself, and its primary relationship is with the state, which is the source of all power and economic output, and therefore it makes it easy to create a society of informers. As far as foodstuffs and essential items go, the five-year plans had presented another dilemma. The end, once again, of private trade and private ownership, and the resumption of largely war communism-esque policies as regards ownership goes, had resulted in a...
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Total loss of artisans within within Russian towns and cities. So in the 1920s and prior to the revolution, an enormous percentage of economic output and manufacturing output in Russia had been provided by artisans. These are people not working in large factories, not working on production lines, craftsmen who are able to make bowls and plates and knives and forks and coats and jackets and shoes. Shoes are this immensely sought-after commodity, real gold dust in Stalin's Russia, because there are simply no cobblers. They've either been forced into some kind of forced labour scheme, or they have been criminalised in some way as a petty bourgeois, or they have simply just abandoned what they do in a bid to avoid the attentions of the state. Government-run food shops have a monopoly on the food supply. The only problem is that many of them don't manage to supply anything at all. There is a perennial problem, and this is something that is seen all the way up to the end of the Soviet Union, of empty shelves. The stores that are not part of any kind of market economy and instead receive their cues directly from the state are notoriously badly run and unreliable, and the conditions that exist for Soviet citizens in that first 5 years, 5 year plan, are frequently close to not exactly outright starvation, though if you're in the countryside, particularly in the Ukraine, it's absolutely like that. But in many of the towns and cities, there's constant hunger. And the period of the first five-year plan in terms of hunger is far more acute than most of the 1920s. This is one of the periods of most intense economic hardship, particularly regarding food, in the history of the Soviet Union. Queuing becomes a regular practice under the first five-year plan. There are frequent stories of people starting queuing at 2 a.m. In the small hours, so that they can get a couple of loaves of bread when the store opens at 6 a.m. The queues see people freeze to death, particularly during Soviet winters, and there's frequent violence explosions of public anger when the store opens and there's people have been queuing for 4 hours and there's nothing there. And I think one of the things that's really interesting and really starts to change that view, that common held view of Soviet society, that everyone was extraordinarily well behaved because they were too terrified to do anything else. There are bread riots during the five-year plans, and constant outpourings of anger and cursing of the Soviet government. And people between 1928 and 1933, at least, have a capacity to do this. It would be interesting, and this will be some further reading on my part, so I'll get back to you on this one, what the situation is like later on at the height of the Great Terror. I'd suspect something quite different. But at least in this initial phase of the first five-year plan, there is plenty of evidence of dissent. And one of the explanations that's come up with by the Soviet citizenry, particularly the very engaged Soviet citizenry, the activists, of things like the Komsomol and the Young Pioneers and party members, but also not just the citizenry but the bureaucracy and the leadership, there is a constant refrain that they have when food doesn't wind up in the stores. This utopia that Soviet citizens should be living in, the fact that it hasn't materialised is that somebody somewhere is sabotaging it, that somebody is to blame for things that are constantly going wrong, because that can be the only explanation. The possibility that an economic and political model has been decided upon, which is proving to be flawed and proving to not supply material gains in the way that it was predicted. This is something that's kind of too dangerous fraught with the possibility of kind of individual and collective crisis, it's too dangerous to entertain. So the hunt for saboteurs, the hunt for wreckers, is constantly on, and there are fanciful stories of bourgeois and kulak conspiracies to destroy foodstuffs. When shoddy and unpleasant foodstuffs wind in the stores, such as, you know, the classic loaf of bread with the rat baked into it, that kind of thing, that this must be the work of wreckers. And there are arrests and trials based upon this, much as with the five-year plans, where you have things like the engineers, the bourgeois specialists trial and the Shakti trial and these kinds of things. And during the first five-year plan, this is a way of explaining why the revolution wasn't panning out in the way that it had been anticipated. There's, of course, one major cause for food shortages during the 1930s and during the five-year plans, and that was the fact that the Soviet Union was a net grain exporter. The reason for this exporting of grain overseas was that it was the only way that Stalin could conceive of being able to raise enough capital to industrialize Russia. This is how you pay for your factories, your machines, and your vehicles. This is something that Stalin is insistent on continuing with, even at a time of mass famine in the early 1930s. One of the interesting facets of Stalin's food policy, and particularly as it pertains to the wider economy, is that of vodka. Vodka was seen by the party as being a very bad thing. It was synonymous with the kind of the old, violent, backward world of the Russian peasantry, something, as I've mentioned before, that the Bolsheviks have very little time for, and was, obviously quite rightly implicated in poor work standards, domestic violence, and every other vice that Soviet society was hopefully going to eliminate. But one of the things about vodka was its vast tax-raising potential. And the government, Stalin, had to concede that trying to promote kind of temperance or abstinence from alcohol was something that the Soviet Union could not afford to do. And by the mid-1930s, vodka is accounting for something like a quarter of all tax revenues in the Soviet Union. It is used as a means, very much like modern governments around the world do, of raising huge sums of revenue. So the economic realities of that really do tell us quite a lot. So what can we conclude from this? Well, I guess the thing that really stands out here is that the five-year plans themselves have an enormous distorting effect on the economy and on Soviet society. The ability to provide basic foodstuffs is undermined because of a restriction or an elimination of basic market trade, which was essential for the five-year plans in order for them to work. And also, there is very little consumer production during the first five-year plan, because everything is diverted towards the needs of heavy industry. This is the reason why so few houses are built and so many people have to be crammed into so many small apartments. It's because the Soviet government is building factories, not tower blocks. So the breakneck speed of industrialization, which does happen extremely rapidly and has huge far-reaching consequences for the Soviet Union, this has unintended social and economic ramifications for ordinary Soviet people. But Stalin was able really to lift his mind from these things. You know, it's not that he was deliberate in lowering living standards for the majority of Soviet citizens, though I'm sure he was quite happy to do so for the former bourgeoisie and the kulaks. But the majority of Soviet citizens, where he saw his power base residing, he believed that it was his role in point of fact to actually elevate their condition, but was quite ambivalent about this when indeed it turns out that he takes the Soviet Union through a prolonged period of hardship and poverty. And during the second five-year plan, as I've mentioned previously, when a consumer economy begins, it's not a reality for most Soviet citizens. It's a reality for a lucky few. Anyway, I hope you found that useful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.